From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea, and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
537 days. That's how long it's been since the Prime Minister of Australia has set foot in Western Australia. But that all changed last night when Scott Morrison touched down in Perth, kicking off a whirlwind tour that'll include a meeting with Mark McGowan, a speaking event in front of the CCI, and taking in an Eagles game at Optus Stadium. The PM joins me now for the first time on The West Live. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Well, g'day, Ben. I'm pleased to be back. I've been looking forward to it. And importantly, I'll be heading up north as well while I'm here. To see firsthand the devastation that's occurred as a result of Seroja. And this has been terrible. And the Premier and I have been in contact over this now for these last few days in particular. And importantly, I can tell people that at 8 o'clock today, Western Australian time, those affected by that cyclone will be able to get access to those $1,000 payments for adults and $400 per child that was approved overnight. And so that's available this morning at 8 o'clock. So that on 1-800-2266.
That's greatly appreciated. As I'm sure you'll see for yourself, it's like a war zone up there. The Shire president said it's like a bomb has gone off. The devastation is just astonishing, staggering, really. And they'll appreciate your visit. Does this mean that you're unofficially on the election trail, being back in WA?
Being in Western Australia has always been part of being Prime Minister. I mean, it's a big country, and that's why I've been pleased to get back here. I mean, 2019-20 were very difficult years, and in 2019, we were beginning with dealing with bushfires back as late as of September of 2019. I just returned from the United States, actually, and we're already dealing with those up in Queensland, and that ran, as you know, all the way through to the end of that year and into 2020, and then we were into the COVID-19 pandemic. And so where the Prime Minister needs to be when those things are occurring is at the helm, and that's where I was in Canberra.
It has been an unprecedented 2 years. Now, I mentioned that you haven't been here for 18 months. We had COVID in there, of course, but your absence during the WA state election was certainly noted by voters. The Liberal brand has been demolished here in WA. It's almost radioactive. How are you going to turn around the party faithful, some of whom voted Labor for the first time?
Well, we saw a similar result up in Queensland. I think what has occurred in COVID is there has been a great deal of consensus between premiers and prime ministers. I mean, the Premier McGowan and I have worked very closely on all the issues relating to COVID, and the federal government has, of course, underwritten financially the Western Australian economy with the considerable supports we've put in, whether it's on JobKeeper, the cash flow boats, the COVID supplement payments, the pensioner payments that we paid. I mean, all of that directly equates to almost $14 billion directly into Western Australia. And then on top of that, that was keeping the flights connected, some 5,300 flights connected to Western Australia that was paid for by the federal government, and some 51,000 tonnes of exports through our international freight program. So the Commonwealth government worked well with the state government and continues to. I'm looking forward to seeing the Premier this afternoon. There are many more issues for us to continue working on here in WA. So I think the leadership of the Premier here in Western Australia was recognised by the people of Western Australia, and I commend him for that, and that we have both been working on that same plan.
Last time I spoke to Premier Mark McGowan, he said that you and he had a good personal relationship, but he said that relationship got a little rocky when the federal government joined Clive Palmer's case against the West Australians' hard borders. You've been here for 12 hours now. Are you getting a sense of how deep the resentment towards Clive Palmer runs over here?
Well, we withdrew from the case, and that came after the discussions I had with the Premier. I mean, the normal process for any Commonwealth government where there's a constitutional case like that is they join a constitutional case. That's the expectation. In fact, the High Court was very upset with us when we pulled out of the case. But we pulled out of the case for the right reasons. The Premier and I talked that issue through, and I think we made the right decision. I mean, the Western Australian situation was very different to the rest of the country, and I've always had a keen understanding of that. And I think I've always understood that the Western Australian economy works quite differently to the rest of the country. And so the impacts of borders here were very different to what we're seeing on the eastern states. Very, very different. And so that's why I took a different approach here in Western Australia.
Do you think there's a challenge for you now to convince West Aussie voters of that? Because arguing constitutional law is always going to be one of those arcane sort of things that might fail to resonate with the electorate, whereas Labor just has to run a picture of you, Christian Porter and Clive Palmer, and it gets the message across very easily.
Well, that would be false if they did that, because we withdrew from the case, listened to the Premier, listened to Western Australians, and took that action. That would just be a lie if they did that.
I'm seeing it in their advertising.
Well, that reflects on them. I think Western Australians know, particularly when it comes to what it was and still continues to be one of the most significant issues that Western Australia has sought justice for, and that was on the GST. As Treasurer and as Prime Minister, I was the one that drafted the deal, worked the deal out, championed the deal. As an Eastern States Prime Minister, there was no one more passionate than me about righting the wrong over the GST for Western Australia than me. Now, you could never bet each way on that, like the Labor Party had and like Anthony Albanese always has on everything. There's no two bets either way with me when it came to the GST and WA. So the only person that you can trust to make sure that deal sticks is the person who made it and the person who championed it, and that was me.
And the GST was a massive issue for us here in Western Australia, and you certainly helped us out with that. Has it hurt you in other states, though?
No, because it was the right thing to do. I mean, there was a real problem, and I acknowledged that there was a real problem as Treasurer and set it about fixing it. And that had meant I had to take the whole country there. I had to get legislation through a very difficult Senate and Parliament. And that took quite a lot of commitment. And if I was not committed to that, it would never have happened. And that's what it needed. And that's why Western Australians can trust me to keep the deal that I made. And I'll be telling the Premier that again today. That deal sticks with me. I am its greatest advocate and its greatest champion.
Well, let's change tack. Former Australia Post Chief Executive Christine Holgate has asked you for an apology. Are you sorry?
Well, that day in Parliament was quite a heated day. The Labor Party was calling for her resignation, I recall. And Parliament can get pretty willing, and I gave a very strong response. I mean, the suggestion was that the government somehow endorsed the use of taxpayers' funds in a government-owned company to hand out Cartier watches to people who already got paid very well and already had performance bonus arrangements as part of their existing salaries. Now, that was not something I agreed with. Now, my language on that day was very strong. It was back in October. I see that has caused some very, very strong reaction from Christine, and it hurt her deeply. And that was not my intention. But I regret that. But at the same time, the issue here was how taxpayers' funds were being used in a government-owned company. And as Prime Minister, I have to stand up for those standards, and did. That's what ultimately this issue was about. I mean, it was not an intention for me to upset or offend Ms. Holgate. I appreciate that she has gone through a difficult time, and that's not something that I would have liked to have seen happen. But the issues when you're in public life, and we run large whether it's running a large organisation like Australia Post or indeed the Prime Minister, we're all accountable for the things that the decisions we make and the things that we do. And there's accountability around that, and that's how this issue began. It was about Cartier watches being handed out to well-paid executives for doing their jobs, and that was not something that my government supported.
You mentioned the hurt that she felt. She said she was treated differently because she was a woman. Given what we've seen in Canberra these past 2 months, could she be right about that?
No, I don't accept that. I mean, that was no more true that Cartier watches were handed out because some of their gender, or then the rules that would apply in relation to that. This was about the issues of taxpayers' money. I know I don't accept that there are any gender-related issues here at all. This was about that issue. Now, my language was strong. Parliament can get very heated. As I said, the Labor Party were calling for her resignation. What I said on that day was that there should be an inquiry, which there was, and it actually confirmed these and a number of other matters. And I said that the CEO should stand aside while they are doing that. And if she did not choose to do that, then she could take that other course. She ultimately decided to resign. Now, that was a choice for her at that time, and those matters are being dealt with between the board of Australia Post and Ms Holgate. They don't involve me as the Prime Minister or the government.
Mm. And do you feel you were adequately briefed on the issue before speaking in Parliament about it?
It was very well. The independent report confirmed what happened with the watches, confirmed a number of other issues as well, which were also troubling, and it was very clear that the statement had been made that this was not taxpayers' money, and I took great difference with that statement, considerable difference with that statement. If you're running a government-owned business, then it is taxpayers' money and it has to be treated like that.
Mm. Now, you're going to visit the Midwest of WA to see the areas affected by Cyclone Seroja. A little bit north is the heart of the WA resource sector, really the heart of the Australian economy. You've said the idea of mining companies vaccinating workers is an interesting one. The bigger problem, of course, is the nationwide rollout. National Cabinet is going to be moving back to a war footing to address this.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've got some challenges to deal with. The first challenge we had was that the 3 million doses from overseas didn't turn up because of the problems that were being experienced in Europe. Now, those circumstances are beyond the government's control. We started the program when we said we'd start it, but its initial rates were lower because of the lack of the supply of those vaccines. Now, we're getting on top of that, and we got up to the point of around about 80,000 vaccinations a day, the majority of those happening through the GPs. And then we got the advice from ATAGI, which is the advisory group to the minister on these on medicines and on these vaccines, which raise some very remote risks in relation to the AstraZeneca vaccine. Now, that has had, and we expect will continue to have, an impact on the take-up and the rollout of the vaccine. Now, that's what we have to address. It is a safe and recommended vaccine for people aged over 50. And the AstraZeneca vaccine continues to be manufactured in Victoria and being rolled out and distributed right across the country. And it's important that we get people aged over 50, and particularly those aged over 70, which is the target group right now, vaccinated, because they are the most vulnerable population, particularly as we go into winter. The vaccine protects people from serious illness. That's its first job. And for those most vulnerable, if there were an outbreak, whether here in Perth or in Melbourne or Sydney or anywhere else, and that went through the community, then the people who are elderly are the most at risk. We saw that in Victoria when there was the breakout there. Now, to prevent or to mitigate the risk of that, we need to get our older population vaccinated, and that can be done safely with the AstraZeneca vaccine. As we move into the second half of this year, when we were planning to move into the balance of the population, those between 50 and 70, and those of younger ages as well, then those particularly under 50 will have the preference on the medical advice for the Pfizer vaccine and indeed the Novavax vaccine. Now, our Pfizer vaccine deliveries will increase in the weeks and months ahead, but we're able to quickly secure a further 20 million doses of Pfizer. Now, we're not expecting that till quarter four of this year, and we're not expecting the Novavax vaccines until quarter four this year as well. So that will mean we'll need to change our rollout to go to mass vaccination options, and that will have to be done in partnership with the states and territories. Now, if we can do all that, then there is the possibility that can be achieved by the end of 2021. But at this stage, there are too many uncertainties, I think, to commit to a timetable like that. I would need, and the states would need to be sure that they could put those arrangements in place and ramp them up and do that safely with the population to achieve that. So there's a lot of work to do together. The rollout has to change because of events. The AstraZeneca vaccine issues that have been highlighted, yes, they're rare, but we have to follow that medical advice for people's safety, and that means we have to now change the rollout because of that. But the earlier phases we're dealing with right now, those over 70, that can be done with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and we're pushing ahead with that. And by mid this year, we hope to be through those vulnerable population priorities. And that's what we're very focused on delivering right now.
I know a timeline is almost impossible given all of the uncertainty, but if you had to decide a sort of an ideal percentage of the population that would be vaccinated by the time we go to the polls, the next federal election, would it be 50%, 75%? What is a likely number?
Well, we're taking advice from our medical experts on that at the moment, so I don't intend to get ahead of that advice. That they are assessing the various scenarios and what sort of level of protection that provides. I mean, you raise a good point, though. I mean, the issue has been raised about opening up international borders. It is still a very dangerous world when it comes to COVID right now, and that's not looking like changing anytime soon. And we have to understand that even with a vaccinated population, that, you know, if we can vaccinate our most vulnerable, the elderly, those with disabilities, those on our front line and our health system and roles like that, then we are protecting ourselves from the worst outcomes of COVID. And if we want to treat COVID like the flu, then we have to have the same tolerance for COVID as we have for the flu. And people get the flu, and there would be cases of COVID if the international borders were lifted. There would be cases, and we'd have to be confident and comfortable that that would be in Australia's interest to have potentially large numbers of cases of COVID, knowing that it would not lead to the horrific outcomes that we saw particularly in Victoria when the second wave ripped through, particularly Melbourne. And so they are real legitimate questions that need to be worked through with states and territories. There's a lot of focus on the daily number of cases, both by state governments, their chief health officers and their premiers, but also by the media. And so we would need to be, I think, of one mind that if we were to go to those steps later in the year or soon after then, there would have to be an appreciation that would come with case numbers for COVID in Australia. And we would have to be understanding of what that meant. And that the goal right now is to make sure our most vulnerable are protected from any possible outbreaks, because we never have 100% certainty against that.
Mm. Is a successful vaccination rollout important to your government's re-election?
It's important to Australia, and that's why it matters, and that's why I'm focused on it.
Mm. Well, now, we know your footy code of choice is rugby league. I'm a Queenslander myself, so I get that. But you'll be at Optus on Friday night for the footy. West Coast taking on the Pies. Will we see you in blue and gold or black and white?
Well, I remember being at the G for the grand final when West Coast won, and it was a very exciting game. It seemed to be quite prophetic too, for another contest the next year. With that kick right from the boundary line, it was quite a remarkable game. So that has always meant I have a soft spot there. As you know, I don't follow any particular AFL team. I think that would be pretty disingenuous. I think people sort of sniff that stuff out. I have my Sharks, and I love my Sharks, and I enjoy going. But I always do enjoy going. What's amazing about it, so many countries in the world right now can't do that. Yes, we've got our challenges, but we are living life here in Australia, and particularly here in Western Australia, and I give credit to the Western Australian government. We've worked together to achieve that result here in Western Australia. That we're living here in a way that so many others around the world are not. And while we have our challenges, I think at the same time it's always important to have that perspective. And on Friday night, I'm hoping to be there with Matthias Cormann, the new Secretary General of the OECD. He'll do a fantastic job, a great Western Australian, and it'll be our first opportunity to really catch up since we were able to secure that result for Australia. And Matthias, I think, will be a great person in that role, drawing on both his values as a Western Australian and particularly as Australia's longest-serving finance minister. And I'm very pleased that he's been appointed to that role.
Well, given where the rest of the world is with the pandemic, it'll be quite a special moment, I'm sure, to be at Optus Stadium, nearly a full house. I hope you enjoy one of our Gage Roads beers while you're there. Prime Minister Scott Morrison, thanks for your time this morning. I know you've got a lot of ground to cover while you're in WA. I'm sure West Aussies will be happy to see you in their patch.
Great to be back. Cheers, Ben.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now in the studio, Sunrise correspondent Cyan Doherty. Good morning, Cyan.
Good morning, Ben.
And now, there has been a serious assault in Byford. What can you tell us?
Well, this is a bit of an unusual one. So a member of the public found this person on the side of the road in Byford overnight. They thought he'd been hit by a car because of his injury, so they've called 000. They've come to pick him up. But police say what's actually happened is that a group of men have passed him, jumped out of the car and just beaten him up, basically, and then taken off. So when they found him, they thought he'd been hit by a car, but actually he's been assaulted, and that person's now in Royal Perth Hospital, and police will investigate why that's happened.
Do they have any idea at this stage, or too early to say?
It is still too early to say, but they are investigating whether or not it's targeted.
Yeah, do they think he was known by these assailants?
Too early to say.
Too early to say, yeah.
But that is definitely a lead they're pursuing. I mean, look at everything that's been happening recently. I don't know if you saw Joy Catanzaro's exclusive story on 7 News last night where Dane Brakovich, the Hell's Angel Sergeant of Arms, turned up at Royal Perth Hospital a few days ago in the emergency department saying he'd had a motorbike accident, but the injuries weren't consistent with that. So there's a lot of things sort of bubbling beneath the surface. So, you know, we'll just see what happens.
Yeah, follow this story closely as we have been doing everything with bikies for the last few months. And now help has arrived for Kalbarri.
Yes, incredibly. So when the Premier visited Kalbarri yesterday, he described it as looking like a war zone. And now, appropriately, the troops, the ADF, has shown up to help with the cleanup. It's not just them. It is an enormous contingent of emergency services workers and volunteers, SES volunteers, and even a bunch of extra police officers. The problem is the job is just enormous. So incredible resilience, incredible will to clean up and rebuild, but they are going to need the help of the Defence Force, of the SES, and of all of the emergency services.
Yeah, it's a massive effort. Yesterday on the show, we spoke to the mayor of the Cassowary Coast, which was a region of Queensland that was hit by Cyclone Yasi in 2011. It was devastated. It caused $3.5 billion worth of damage. And one thing that he highlighted for me that I think is interesting here is that the cleanup is so difficult, the rebuild is so challenging, so many different agencies are involved that you need a strong leader to oversee it all. Previously in Queensland with Cyclone Larry, the Queensland government appointed Peter Cosgrove, who went on to become the Governor General of Australia, in that role as a sort of a disaster coordinator, just to make sure that everybody knows what their jobs are and they're not sort of pulling in different directions. I don't think we've heard from the WA government yet if such a person has been appointed here or whether it'll be filled by Chris Dawson. Hard to imagine him taking on that responsibility as well as being the top cop. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
It is a big call for the new Emergency Services Minister, Rhys Whitby, to make.
Massive.
And this is one of those situations you watch and you just feel sort of helpless. I mean, most of us have been to Kalbarri. We've seen that town. The pictures are so devastating. But there is something that we can do to help, and that is because the Lord Mayor's Disaster Relief Fund is back up. It's been activated, and the state government kicked it off with a $2 million donation, but they need a lot more. I don't know if you heard the stats, but I believe it's 75% of buildings in Kalbarri have been impacted by the cyclone and 1 in 10 destroyed.
It's staggering. It's going to take so long. We read in the paper today that it could take 2 years to get it back to where it was.
Yeah.
For a very popular tourism town in WA, not to mention all the locals that live there, just absolutely heartbreaking to see. I hope the Lord Mayor's Disaster Relief Fund can even get close to what it did for the bushfires. What was it, 16 million? Something like that?
Yeah, it was a record amount. And, you know, that was devastating as well. It's just one thing after another at the moment. WA can't catch a break.
Yeah, can't catch a break. Cyan, thanks for being on the show. Are you back tomorrow or we got
Matty? No, Matt Tinney. I've just been keeping Matt's seat warm, but he's back tomorrow.
Ah, well, we'll put up with Matty, I guess. thanks for all your help on the West Live this week.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've heard from the PM this morning about how he intends to win over West Aussie voters, but it's going to be easier said than done. Joining me now to unpack what ScoMo said this morning is Senior Politics Lecturer at Notre Dame University, Dr. Martin Drum. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, good. Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
So you listened to what the Prime Minister said this morning. What were your takeaways?
Oh, well, I think he's very, very keen to re-engage with West Australians. He knows it's been a long time since he's been here. And he has to, you know, reframe himself as a Prime Minister for West Australians. And I think he's, you know, he's talked up the presence of West Australians in Cabinet. He's talked up his cooperation with Mark McGowan on certain areas. He's talked down his association with Clive Palmer. So he's trying to frame some of those things that he knows has been a bit of a problem for him, trying to frame them in the right light to try and move on from that, what happened earlier this year with the election.
And he said that he didn't need to visit WA as much because he's got so many West Australians in his cabinet. What's your take on that? And do you think that will fly with the voters?
No, I think the Prime Minister needs to be out and on the ground. He's right. You know, he does have a very strong presence in the federal cabinet, but you still need to be out and on the ground. And this is never more true than in a place like Western Australia, where we feel we're a long, long way away from Canberra. And if we don't see our Prime Minister or opposition leader or major party leader, then it's a bit of a problem. And I would expect and hope that we'd probably see him a bit more frequently for the rest of this year.
And how do you think he's going to be received here in WA? Because obviously, while he hasn't been here, it's been giving a lot of free kicks to Mark McGowan and the Labor Party. But now that he's on the ground, it's going to be a bit like a royal visit where people might talk about being a republic and being anti-monarchy. But then when the royals arrive, that's all forgotten and everybody, you know, comes out to see them.
I think he'll probably get a reasonably good reception. You know, people like seeing their prime minister. No matter what strip he's come from. So I think that he'll be welcome, and he'll be especially welcome, I imagine, in those cyclone-ravaged areas to the north of Perth, to the north of Perth, where, you know, there's been a lot of damage and where they'll very much appreciate some federal government support.
And what do you think we'll see him doing while he's here? Shaking hands, kissing babies?
Apart from the cyclone visit, which is very timely, it's an opportunity for him to be out and about and helping those people. I expect him to focus a lot on stimulus-type measures. We've got a lot of economic issues. I know that we're doing relatively okay in an economic sense, but I'd expect him to be focusing on projects that feature WA businesses and focusing on jobs and rebuilding the economy. I think that's probably his main focus.
And so the hot topic today, of course, is Christine Holgate, the former CEO of Australia Post. She was scathing in her criticism of Scott Morrison in a Senate inquiry this week, saying that he'd humiliated her and is deeply hurt. She was left suicidal and on medication. She's said that she needs an apology from Scott Morrison. He regretted the language that he used speaking to us today on the West Live. Do you think it's important to his image to offer a more formal public apology to Christine Holgate?
Well, he might get in contact with her personally and have a chat with her about how all that was handled. That's one of those issues that obviously it'll be a focus on the national political scene. He might be a bit away from that issue a bit here in Western Australia. And it may not feature quite as heavily. But obviously she's pretty upset about how she was treated and how she exited. So it's another one of those issues just plaguing the Prime Minister and probably impacting on his ability to move beyond those issues and focus on things like the vaccine rollout, which is, again, another one that's been a bit of a thorn in his side.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that because we spoke about it to him directly this morning. National Cabinet is now set to meet more often. It's going to go on what they call a war footing as they try and get this vaccine rollout back on track. How can he use these National Cabinet meetings to get that back on track and, I guess, to show leadership when it comes to the rollout? And how important do you think that is to his re-election?
He wants to rewind the conversation back to how it was when the pandemic hit and when there was a lot of cooperation between state and federal authorities and between state and federal political leaders. And that gave him a degree of cover and he looked very statesmanlike and people were very pleased overall with how our response to the pandemic went. And I think he'd like to get back to that type of scenario. It is really useful and important for state and federal governments to be on the same page with these types of issues. So he's got a point there. And it is a bit unseemly when there's been a lot of blame game and, you know, problem shifting between state and federal levels of government. So it does make sense. It doesn't, of course, put any more vaccines on the ground. So that's the difficulty. He might be able to help with the messaging, but I think there's still some of the underlying problems that we've got with our vaccine rollout won't disappear because of that.
And how do you think he's going to go over the next couple of days? He's going to meet with Premier Mark McGowan. The challenge that he's got is he has to try and win support for the Liberals, but if he criticises Mark McGowan, that's not going to play very well to West Aussies. How does he balance that?
I think he'll try and look statesmanlike. I don't think he'll be coming over here and lashing Mark McGowan. I think that he's, like I said, he's with the Clive Palmer, you know, situation, kind of play down those instances in the past where there's been tension between the two and talk up their relationship. And he'll also, I presume, you know, spend a bit of time with state Liberal personalities and look at what they can do around rebuilding the brand there, because he'll need a lot of those organisational capacity come next year when the election's on. So I think that work has to start now.
Well, senior lecturer in politics at Notre Dame, Dr. Martin Drum, I know you'll be watching ScoMo's visit as closely as us. Thanks for being on the West Live today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, amongst all the devastation and heartache, even those who have suffered great losses are just happy to be alive in Kalbarri. And one of those people is Rebecca Bond. When our producers called her this morning, they reported back to me that she's keeping pretty upbeat despite losing about 40% of her Kalbarri home. Rebecca, welcome to the West Live.
Good morning. How are you?
Probably better than you. Can you take us through what your week has been like?
Pretty hectic. I think prior preparation, knowing the devastation a cyclone can cause after being in North Queensland, I was very prepared, but still not prepared or getting my head around what has actually happened and the devastation around Kalbarri.
Oh, yeah. So you say you're from North Queensland. I'm from Queensland myself. Have you lived through cyclones? Can you give us some idea of the ones that you've seen?
Yes, we went through Larry in 2006. I'm from Cairns in North Queensland, and that was a Category 5. We didn't really get that much like what we did here, being right in the front line, but all the houses aren't built to cyclone standards, unknown to me until yesterday. So I didn't think the cyclone would actually track this far south myself, but it is quite scary.
Well, you make a good point. The houses in that region are not built to cyclone standards. It's been, I think, 50 years or so since the last one hit the region. Are you planning on staying in Kalbarri? And if you rebuild, will you rebuild stronger?
We will come back bigger, better and stronger. I'm actually here with my 88-year-old Nana, Joyce Doyle, who is a journalist or a pre-journalist from the ABC, and my mum, so I'm definitely not leaving. But I think the community will come back much bigger, better and stronger.
Yeah, well, we hope so. We've certainly got our fingers crossed for everybody in Kalbarri. And now, what's open up there at the moment? You mentioned the fish and chip shop earlier.
Yes, the Kalbarri fish and chip shop has a generator. I'm sitting here with my dirty chai from the beautiful stuff at Angie's Cafe. The IGA is open from 8 till 4 today. Unfortunately, to everyone's disappointment, the pub and the tavern are still closed.
But, have they been able to save any of the beer?
We saved beer, yes. I think that was probably the busiest shop in town the night before was the pub.
And if you had a chance to walk around, can you describe the devastation?
I'm sitting here on my mum's back veranda, and they have 21 chalets in the Sun River Chalet. 5 of those homes have no roof. 5 of those people are actually homeless. Tudor Caravan Park has taken them on, as they are giving free accommodation to the cyclone-affected victims. As to my knowledge, I'm not too sure about anybody else opening up and lending a hand when it comes to accommodation.
So what is the plan now? Like, what are the next steps in the days, weeks and months ahead?
It has looked like a big plane has come and dropped a bomb on Kalbarri. It is absolutely horrific. I went for a drive this morning and I just can't believe that there was no death or injury. There is a big clean-up process ahead of us. I believe the army came in at lunchtime yesterday to give us a hand. The SES were absolutely exhausted. Today I feel exhausted. I think the adrenaline's worn off and the severity of the cyclone has hit us all. And just a long road ahead. I think it'll take us months, even years, to rebuild our community. But we will get there.
Well, I spoke on the show yesterday to the mayor of Mission Beach about the wake of Cyclone Yasi in 2011.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember? Did you live through that one?
I was in Bali, I think, at that time.
That was a good place to be because Yasi was terrible in Queensland. And he said that Mission Beach, 10 years later, is still, I guess, wearing the scars from that cyclone. Because there's so much that needs to be repaired, rebuilt. Mm. People need to get confidence again. And it's a tourism area as well. Tell me about the spirit of people in Kalbarri today.
Bit like Mission Beach, pretty laid back. Though most, can I also add that most of those homes in Cairns and North Queensland are built with Besser blocks. Here in Western Australia, I don't even think I've seen a Besser block on any house. There's lots of fibre shacks and brick. Fortunately, we're in brick. But, we're definitely going to have the scar for this for years to come.
Mm. And would you back the local shire there of Northampton improving its building codes to take into account the rare occurrence of a cyclone?
Absolutely. They'd be mad not to. I'm sure there'll be an uproar if nothing's done soon. I'm sure it's definitely rattled a few chains when it comes to cyclone building in the future.
Rebecca Bond, thank you so much for talking to us today. We wish you all the best as you pick up the pieces of Cyclone Seroja.
Thank you very much for your chat today. Enjoy your week.
The Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, is coming to Perth for the West Australians event series, Leadership Matters. It's happening on Thursday, April 22 at Crown Perth. This is an opportunity to hear direct from the Minister who oversaw the government's economic response to the COVID crisis. The event is also a unique chance to put your questions direct to the Federal Treasurer. You don't want to miss it. You can purchase tickets at events.thewest.com.au.
The Wild West.
Well, I thought it was pretty special to get ScoMo on the show today, but let's be honest, here's the highlight. Perth Now editor, Nat Richards.
Good morning. How are you?
How are you? Did you ever think you'd share a show with the Prime Minister?
Of course. Come on, Ben.
Yeah, exactly.
I know my worth.
let's go straight to the outback of
yes.
WA, where there's concerns about a petrol station.
Yeah. Well, imagine this, right? You can't really go many places at the moment. So you thought, oh, I'll go on an Aussie holiday. I'll take the Canberra Trailer out for a drive. I'll go across the Noarbor. And you know what? As always happens when you do these long drives, right? Need a fuel station. Stop off at the Eucla, fill up with diesel and off you go.
Yeah, maybe get a pie.
And then you break down in the middle of nowhere. And that's exactly what's been happening to people, is that they've been pulling up at this fuel station, filling up with diesel. And then mysteriously, they get a few Ks down the road and they break down. And they're stuck in the middle of nowhere with nothing. And this is what's been happening to people. And Consumer Protection have put out this alert now saying that anybody that's visited a station in the Eucla and has had trouble with breakdowns needs to contact them and lodge an official complaint, because it's concerns now that the fuel has been contaminated. And just the worst possible place that this could happen in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, not only is there no mechanics, there's no petrol stations where you can get more petrol.
Exactly.
There's no water.
I mean, luckily there are some within a reasonable-ish distance
like
of this
six-hour
particular
walk or something.
Yeah, with this station. But it's, I mean, can you imagine? You are stuck out there. That it's got to be the worst nightmare for somebody that's not very, you know, not very savvy with these sorts of things. And
like, are you saying like a millennials living the van life?
Or poms like myself, you know. You've got to appreciate the size of Australia.
Yeah, it's huge.
And it's massive. It's only when you get on the road that you realise everything takes forever to get from A to B. And, yeah, you've got this problem with fuel that means that you could end up broken down in the middle of nowhere. It's the stuff of nightmares for people. So this has been happening. Consumer Protection wants you to get in touch with them if you've had trouble. Bit of a worry for those people. I just can't imagine what that would be like, especially if you went late at night.
Have you ever done that drive across the Noarbor?
I have not. My husband has. I said it was the most boring experience of his life. I'll take his word for it and have no plans on doing it. So I'll be getting the plane from now on, I think.
Well, I think the only time West Aussies really do it is if the the Eagles or the Dockers have made the grand final in Melbourne.
And they can't get a flight.
They can't get a flight.
Or they don't want to remortgage the house for a flight.
Exactly. Yep. I haven't done it. And now I probably won't.
Well, it gets me that, you know, you don't have peak hour over here or anything like that, but everything's miles away from each other, isn't it?
Like
in the UK, you can drive what would take you 5 minutes without traffic and it can take you an hour. Yeah, over here, it's the opposite. You can go full speed, but it'll take you forever to get there because everything's miles away from each other. You even got to drive down your drive over here in some places.
I know.
A trek down your drive.
Yeah, I know. Some houses, definitely. And so now take your Perth Now hat off. Mm-hmm. I want you to put on your official West Live Royal Watcher hat.
You know, that's my favourite hat. You know it.
I'm imagining it's maybe like purple velvet with like a gold trim or something like that.
Of course it is. I turn up here in a ball gown every day, Ben. What are you on about?
So what's the latest?
So this is brilliant. The Sussex PR machine is in full throttle once again. So we've had the statements come out from William and Harry that we spoke about yesterday about Philip's death, and we said how different they were, and that Williams was very, very reserved.
Yeah, formal.
Spoke about his duty, spoke about how his wife and children had got to know him. And we said that there's perhaps, there could be a few pot shots at Harry there if you read it in the right ways. And now, Omid Scobie, who's a journalist and he works Well, he seems to have a very close relationship with Meghan and Harry, in so much so that he wrote that book, Finding Freedom, which is seen to be, you know, the ghost written by them.
PR exercise, really.
It is. At the very least, it's good PR for them. Possibly they've been involved in it. I can't say I've read it, and I can't see how they weren't involved in it, frankly. So anyway, this guy is very well connected to the Sussexes, and he's come out and put on this long spray on Twitter saying, oh, William won't have meant it that way. They're all trying to put this behind them. I understand that, you know, they're just trying to get on now, and there's no bad blood at all, and they're just trying to put it all behind them for Philip's funeral. Come on. Come on. I hold grudges, and I know it doesn't go away that easily. In fact, I know that a funeral is, or a wedding or anything like
any
that
kind
is
of family
the
gathering.
Best thing for making all these tensions flare.
Yes, especially after they've had a few. Well, what would the royals drink? Gin and tonic?
Oh, whiskey.
A whiskey.
Really good old scotch.
I can imagine over a few balloon glasses of brandy. Oh, then the truth comes out, doesn't it? That's what always happens at the relative gathering.
There's going to be fireworks at that wake, isn't there? Because let's make no mistake about it.
But she's not.
That wake will be a piss up, right? It's like any other wake. There'll be lots of drinks going round. They'll all be out supping a bit, and there's going to be some arguments over that. I can imagine. I love to be a fly on the wall. Yeah. It's going to be explosive.
The only person who won't join in is Prince Andrew. People in glass houses. He'll just be staying quiet in the corner.
Also, he won't be sweating either, will he? So, so the interesting thing is, look, now it seems like they're feeding things to him, and, you know, This journalist has come out, who's a cheerleader for the Sussexes, saying, oh, there's no bad blood. It's like they're trying to play it down. Totally is. There's also talk, however, while we're talking about this, obviously Harry's been stripped of all his military roles now because he's left the royals. There's talk now that he won't be able to wear his suit as he walks behind the coffin, so his full military regalia.
Well, he's going to go Las Vegas hotel room attire.
Well, no, you will be
cupping the crown jewels.
Can you imagine? That would be we'd be talking about that on Westlife. He'll be able to wear his full regalia. So, and of course, William will be able to because he's still an active royal. Now that could cause some embarrassment for Harry, who's made no secret about the fact that he was quite upset about losing those roles.
And it would be, you know, like I feel for him a bit because he did.
That's sad.
He did serve.
Yeah,
you can't take that away from him.
He did. So there's talk now that William might wear a plain suit as well
that'd be a nice gesture.
It's awkward. It would, but I think that would say it all, wouldn't it, as well? It's obviously a problem.
So if William wears a plain suit, we know that the rift is being mended. If he wears his full military regalia with all of those, honorary ribbons and various other things, we'll know the rift is on.
That's it.
It's on, baby.
Bring it. It's like wearing white to a wedding, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, let's just wait and see what happens. We've still got another couple of days until the funeral happens. And I know, Nat Richards, you're going to keep us apprised of everything that's going on.
Oh, you know it. Thanks, Ben.
Well, that's it from me today. You can catch us live tomorrow morning when we return to thewest.com.au and Perth Now at 8:45 a.m. And you can stream the full show whenever you want by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.
Enigma of the Dark. The case of the Claremont serial killings. The must-read book that takes you inside the trial of the century. Gripping details of the case that shocked a nation. A fascinating and solid record by author Tim Clark. Order your copy now, Enigma of the Dark, from amazon.com.au.